The Tom Woods Show, episode 551.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, Christmas is coming, and there is no better gift to get for your libertarian friend or relative than a subscription to LibertyClassroom.com. They'll never lose a debate again. At LibertyClassroom.com, they can learn in courses they can listen to while on the go all the things we were not taught in school. Real history, real economics, other fields, plus Q&A forums. Get all your questions answered. Learn from the best the Liberty Movement has to offer. Check it out at LibertyClassroom.com. Friends, today is the day you've been waiting for. Well, maybe. I hope so. Darn well should be, because this is a really good episode. This is the audio of the debate I did with Michael Malice in New York City on the subject of Alexander Hamilton. You know about Michael Malice. He's a celebrity ghostwriter. He is the author of Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. You can catch him regularly on the Fox Business Network and also on the Fox News Channel. You can also visit him at michaelmalice.com. Now, on the show notes page for today, tomwoods.com/551, I will have links to the visuals that were going on. You'll notice that people are laughing at apparently random moments during Michael's opening statement. That's because he's got in the background a hysterical PowerPoint presentation that's running behind him, and you'll want to see this. Believe me, you will want to see this. So that will be linked at tomwoods.com/551. I'm also going to link to the video of the debate, and you will enjoy the video too, particularly the opening credits. They're done in the style of Dallas, the 80s TV show. And if you never saw that, well, check out on YouTube what the opening credits looked like on Dallas, and you'll see how awesome the video that was done for us looks. It was done by our friend John F. King, and if you would like videography services done that are of high quality, as you'll see this video is, then you can contact John through facebook.com/inevitable. Now, if you've been listening to all the episodes this week, you already know who the winner of the debate was, but I'm going to save those numbers for the end because, of course, remember the audience is polled before and after. I'm going to save those numbers for the end, just in case you want to be kept in suspense and you don't know what the outcome was. So that's going to happen then. I also want to point out that we set an attendance record for the sponsoring organization, the Junto, which has been around for many years in New York City, sponsoring events like this. And in fact, the venue they used actually wrote them an angry note saying that they were not in compliance with the rules, which state that you've got to keep these events to 150 to 160 people. They said people were stuffed in that room, all squished together, and you can't do that. So how about that, huh? Okay, this is going to go right into the opening statement by Michael Malice, and it's going to skip some fun stuff that happened at the beginning that you can watch in the video at tomwoods.com/551. All right, that's enough talking by me. Here we go.
We are here to discuss the resolution, Alexander Hamilton was a hero for the cause of liberty. Now, there are some people that I would regard as heroes for the cause of liberty that I would not feel comfortable defending in front of a crowd. One of my personal heroes, Albert Camus, was a French philosopher. His philosophy of absurdism was at odds with Rand's philosophy of objectivism, but he managed to sum up my worldview in one achingly beautiful sentence: it is the job of thinking people not to be on the side of the executioners. Lech Walesa, 1989 in Poland. I haven't even looked up his political philosophy. I'm sure it's some kind of run-the-mill, terrible welfare state liberalism, but he brought down the Polish government through democratic process, liberating a country and then the Eastern Bloc. When Gorbachev refused to send in the tanks to Poland in 1989 and lost, you know, the communist empire, in my opinion, but I would not defend this in this crowd, he was a hero for the cause of liberty. So what I wanted to find, what is a definition of heroism that we would all find honest and objective? And since this is an Ayn Rand group, I looked through objectivist writings, and I found something from Leonard Peikoff. Now, every year, Ayn Rand used to go to Ford Hall Forum in Boston, which is called the Objectivist Easter. And after she died, her heir, Leonard Peikoff, went there. And Leonard Peikoff gave a talk about his years with Ayn Rand. He ended it with the following: I do not believe that we can know Ayn Rand only as she appeared to somebody or other, but if I were to grant that premise for a split second, if I were to agree that we construe reality to our personal preferences, I would still draw a moral distinction between two kinds of preferences: those of the muckrakers and those of the hero worshipers. It is the distinction between people who, confronted by a genius, are seized with a passion to ferret out flaws, real or imaginary, against people who, desperate to feel admiration, want to dismiss any flaw as trivial because nothing matters to them in such a context but the sight of human greatness that inspires and awes them. In this kind of clash, I'm sure you recognize where I stand. Now, I think Tom kind of screwed the pooch on this one because given the resolution, I don't think it's debatable. I think it's kind of tautological because there are many people who are heroes for the cause of liberty who didn't do that much. Paul Revere rode a horse. He's a hero for the cause of liberty. Thomas Paine wrote a pamphlet. He's a hero for the cause of liberty. That one action defines you. If we had a resolution, is Lee Harvey Oswald a murderer? Oh, he only killed someone once. You know, this other time he held an old lady across the street. It takes a great deal and a great accomplishment, but that one accomplishment is enough, in my opinion, for the resolution to pass. So let's discuss Hamilton and Hamilton's life. I listened to the Tom Woods show from 2 weeks ago, episode number, Tom, do you remember 371 or something like that? And he had this great episode about this National Review piece, which I'm sure was terrible, because the National Review is awful, everything they say is wrong. And you had, as your guest, the historian Kevin Gutzman, and the episode was attacking Hamilton, and what did he say? Your guy on your show, attacking Hamilton, says, the National Review piece also exaggerates Hamilton's personal virtues, which I think is hard to do. Although I don't like his political virtues, I think Hamilton was a heroic person. His story is spectacular. This is your guy on your show 2 weeks ago, episode 379, or whatever it was. And what is Hamilton's, why is this important? Every country in the world says they're free. Everyone's for liberty. China, Stalin, Hitler. You've never seen so much liberty. Everywhere is liberty. The gates of Auschwitz, the doorway to hell, spoke of freedom. Arbeit macht frei, work makes you free. So how do we know if a society is actually free? What, we're gonna look at the Heritage Foundation Index of Economic Freedom? The surest measure of freedom in a country and why America has traditionally and correctly been called the freest country in the world is social mobility. If you live in a country where you are not screwed due to the circumstance of your birth, your gender, your race, your economic class, your sexual orientation, your religion, and you are free to rise and fall simply due to your merits or demerits, that is a country that is free, that is a free society. So what did your guy, your historian say on your show? By the time Hamilton was in his mid-teens, the shipping magnate he was working for felt so comfortable leaving town for weeks and leaving Hamilton 15 or 16 in charge of a gigantic mercantile shipping operation. If it were a novel, no one would believe it. That sounds pretty heroic. Hamilton was such a piece of lowlife from birth. He was born in an island called Nevis in the Caribbean, an island which is known for the fact that Hamilton was born there. That's all we know about it. He was born to a mom. His biological father left her while he was pregnant. He was absolutely coming from nothing. And because he was so brilliant, he kept getting all these promotions. From Nevis, he got a scholarship to King's College, which became Columbia, due to his genius. And from Columbia, he went on to join the Revolutionary Army and was George Washington's aide-de-camp. And as Ayn Rand put it, America is the land of the uncommon man. It is the land where man is free to develop his genius and to get its just rewards. It is the land where each man tries to develop whatever quality he may possess and rise to whatever degree he can, great or modest, whether one glories or is taught to glory in one's mediocrity. So the Revolutionary War happens. Hamilton is assigned to be George Washington's aide-de-camp, his right-hand man. We don't know how old he is. He came from such a low social status, we're not even sure of the year of his birth. What happened? Now, are you going to tell me, and I would love Tom to say this with a straight face so I could put it on his picture and put it all over Facebook, that all the Revolutionary War veterans weren't heroes for the cause of liberty? How is that possible? Every single one of these men who fought in that Revolutionary War against enormous odds was a hero. This is, and again, I know in debates we like to think that both sides have something to say, and I'm sure there's a lot to say against Hamilton, that's fair, but given how this resolution is worded, it's not really debatable. Okay? What were some of the things that Hamilton did? Washington was so enamored with him that there was this other competing general, Horatio Gates, and even though Washington was ostensibly in charge of everything, people didn't recognize his authority because it was this kind of loose confederacy. Washington sent Hamilton to get a regiment from Gates, 22-year-old kid, which is like Harry Reid sending an intern to Mitch McConnell to get his staff to go work for him. And Hamilton did it. Gates was being so insubordinate, he was refusing to report to Washington, reporting to Congress directly, and Hamilton still got what he needed out of him. So that's one way that he's a hero for the cause of liberty, as were all the Revolutionary War soldiers. That's another reason. Okay, what happens next? Constitution. Is Tom going to tell me with a straight face? Again, the resolution isn't, was Hamilton the most pro-liberty founding father? The resolution is not, was Hamilton, you know, have some things we disagree with? Was he a hero for the cause of liberty? And I would love to hear Tom say, with a straight face, not all the founding fathers were heroes for the cause of liberty. The Constitution Convention comes across, and you know how sometimes you'll hear something and it sounds really smart? And then later, you're like, wait a minute, this, if you think about it for 5 seconds, it's insane, it makes no sense. Like, the early bird gets the worm. Really? The first person is always in the best position, like in buying stocks or buying a house. It's the bird that's at the appropriate time that gets the worm. And here's another one. In the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that men are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights." Self-evident? It's self-evident that people have rights. Really? How is everyone so easy to ignore this throughout the history of the world and in every country on earth? It's BS. So what happens? The Constitutional Convention's there. Hamilton is the one preaching for the aristocratic principle. He is worried about the mob. He is worried about how do you preserve the rights of the few when it's a numbers game against the greed of the many. I don't even want to look. And as Leonard Peikoff put it, the United States is the first nation in history to be created on the basis of ideas. Now, when the Constitution was going around, you know, there was a kind of an issue, is it going to get ratified? And Tom thought I was going to bring it up in his podcast, and I didn't, I'm bringing it up now. Hamilton wrote the Federalist Papers to explain the ideas behind the Constitution. Those Federalist Papers, here's how Jefferson described them. The best commentary on the principles of government which ever was written. It was an engineering manual explaining how and why a constitutionally limited government would work in practice, and he got a lot of it wrong because nothing like this had ever been tried before. As they left the Constitutional Convention, there's this famous story where someone approached Ben Franklin and said, "Mr. Franklin, what kind of government have you created?" And he said, "A republic, if you can keep it." That was the question. Nothing like this had been done, can it be done? And the Constitution is just a piece of paper. It's the ideas behind the Constitution that matter and that cause it to be implemented. And every country on earth has a constitution to this day. North Korea, Stalinist Russia, they all have it. And this is a huge move forward for liberty because there is a universal consensus that human rights exist. And the reason these ideas are promulgated through all these different cultures is in large part due to the Federalist Papers, which is still being studied in universities today. Now, are you going to tell me that Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, wasn't a hero for the cause of liberty? She wrote a book. The book forced everyone, including many in the South, to examine slavery and what it meant. Be like, you know what? I don't like this. Something's wrong. And that book changed America and has profound effects to this day. She's a hero for the cause of liberty. You can't say with a straight face that the author of the Federalist Papers, three of them, Hamilton wrote like two-thirds, Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, weren't all heroes for the cause of liberty. It's a tautology, and it's absolutely undeniably true. So here's the knock against Hamilton. The Federalist Papers were the John Galt speech for the Constitution. That's how to best look at it. Now, Hamilton gets attacked because he wanted a strong government, and this is an example of definition switching. Because I can say Ayn Rand was a very strong woman, and my friend who's a bodybuilder will say, how much can she bench? And the answer is negligible. Because when I say strong, I don't mean physically strong, I mean psychologically strong, emotionally strong. When Hamilton said a strong government, as Tom will surely admit, he didn't mean Chairman Mao or Stalin or totalitarianism. He meant an effective government. And some people criticize this by saying, well, if we can't have complete freedom, a weak government's better than a strong government, and because they think of it as a spectrum, right? And you just want to get as close to zero as possible. But the correct way to look at it is musical chairs. Because what if, people forget the opportunity cost. Let's suppose I have a terrible job. So not only do I not have a good job, I'm also forestalled from being, when I'm unemployed, from looking for a good job, so I have the worst of all worlds. So when he said a strong government, he meant a government that does what it says and means what it means, but is still limited in its scope. and we know what a weak government looks like. It's not Ancapistan, it's Detroit. In Detroit, you have a government that has abrogated to itself the right of protection services and doesn't fulfill them, so everyone loses. So when he says he wants a strong government, that's what he meant. He didn't mean a complete comprehensive government. Now, what were the two things that Hamilton was worried about in his case for government? The enemy abroad, at 5 minutes left? Oh, damn, I'm screwed. Okay, the enemy abroad and the enemy from within. What's going on in Hamilton, you know, joins Washington's cabinet. He's the Secretary of the Treasury. Before Washington's first term is out, the French Revolution is going on. America's closest ally and aristocratic women are being decapitated in the streets, their limbs pulled apart. Marie Antoinette's best friend's head was brought to her in jail so she could kiss her goodbye. And according to Tom, what did you say on your show, episode 379? It seems to me that Jefferson was continuing to promote and cheer for the French Revolution long after it was unreasonable for anyone to do so. This is what he was up against. So he's like, how do we keep this mob from taking over this country? We have to have a strong, effective government that is inured from democracy. And in fact, Jefferson later said such things as, if every country had been left with just one Adam and Eve, it would have been worth it to vindicate the principles of the French Revolution. Yes, I'm not saying Jefferson was for genocide, but he's certainly opening a door in a very dangerous way when people like that think there's no problems with guillotines in the street. And here's the big, big crux of the argument. There's this big deal between Hamilton and Jefferson. They're both in the cabinet. Are we going to pay off the Revolutionary War soldiers? The Revolutionary War soldiers were the sans-culottes. The sans-culottes from the French Revolution were the shoeless. The Revolutionary War veterans also had no shoes. And they had to sell off their IOUs that they were paid for by the government. And as a result, the question became, are they going to be paid off at face value? Are we going to go for the original owners or so on and so forth? And this is a question of, is this going to be a country of contracts? Or is this going to be a country where we don't pick winners? Are property rights absolute? If I sell my script to somebody else, is that person a property holder? Or can I say, oh, I was a poor Revolutionary War veteran, undo this contract government? Because that's what Jefferson wanted. Jefferson said specifically, in the bill for funding and paying these men, Hamilton made no difference between the original holders and the fraudulent purchasers of this paper. The people he was up against regarded speculation and financing as theft and papal shuffling, and it's the same thing as the Elizabeth Warrens of today, where basically you didn't build that and these people should be rewarded. Hamilton is the only founding father, and I've got a lot more to say, is the only founding father who envisioned America as the city of industry, whereas Jefferson wanted us to live as farmers because these were the children of God. Now, let me conclude very briefly. Ayn Rand once said, the sign of the dollar that I wear, and Hamilton's, the finance system we have was strictly due to Hamilton and Hamilton alone. The dollar sign stands as the money of a free economy for achievement, for success, for ability, for man's creative power, and precisely for these reasons, it is used as a brand of infamy. It stands for the initials of the United States of America. And I think I'm going to leave it there because I've got a lot more to go, but I want to hear what Tom has to say. Thank you.
Well, Gene, Michael, this august organization, and you, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank all of you. And as Michael said, I also want to make clear at the outset that I'm very fond of Michael Malice. I hold him in very high regard, and I consider him to be a man of high intelligence. I want to place special emphasis on his intelligence because it might be difficult for you to perceive it beneath all the preposterous nonsense he's uttering tonight. John Marshall called Alexander Hamilton one of the greatest men who ever lived. Well, Marshall would say something like that, but Michael Malice has done him one better, calling him the greatest man who ever lived.
Nope.
That was back on episode 411.
Nope.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
I said that was my opinion. I can't defend that.
Okay, he said it was
his opinion.
You're
lying about me.
Yep. I accept that friendly amendment. Well, I dissent from that judgment, and vigorously so. So permit me to share with you now the other 98% of the story that Mr. Malice omitted,
and without which we cannot render an informed judgment. Now, I realize that I am defying the conventional wisdom by arguing in the negative tonight. Everybody admires Alexander Hamilton. On the left, they admire him. On the right, they admire him. He's one of the beloved figures in American history. But if American history has taught me anything, beloved figures are the worst of all. Now, it is not necessary, in taking this position, for me to deny any merit at all to Hamilton. To the contrary, Hamilton did say and do things that were absolutely beyond reproach. And Michael mentioned some of them. Moreover, he returned from public life poorer than when he entered it. How many of our statesmen can we say that about today? He defended the persecuted Tories after the Revolution. In fact, he held off an angry mob seeking the blood of the Tory president of Columbia College just with his eloquent speech. However, I want to argue to you tonight that these things cannot compensate for the catastrophic and horrifying things that he did to undermine the cause of liberty, and we still live with these consequences today. Consequences that make the offenses of George III look like bits of trivial nothingness. Now, I won't dwell on Hamilton's support for protective tariffs, since my opponent concedes that Hamilton was mistaken in this. But, on the other hand, in supporting protective tariffs, a policy that was expanded by his followers, he has provided ample grist for the mill of those many journalists, politicians, and academics who ascribe American economic success to Hamiltonian tariff walls. I also won't discuss, at least in the beginning, the First Bank of the United States, which is also a creature of Hamilton. He favored a system of bounties, that is, subsidies for industry, which is precisely the British system, where the king rewards his favorites. This was the one feature of Hamilton's economic program that even the U.S. Congress had the good sense to reject. Above all, he wanted to bind the interests of the wealthy to the federal government. Well, we sure got that. Now, I'd like instead to spend the bulk of my time discussing the United States Constitution and Alexander Hamilton's indefensible, dishonest, and portentous interpretations of that document. We still live under this today, I might add. So if we're going to celebrate Hamilton, we must, if we are to be consistent, celebrate the system under which we live today, which is an entirely Hamiltonian one. The Constitution was sold to the American public in a certain way. I can show you more than half a dozen state ratifying conventions in which the people were told that the federal government would have only the enumerated powers. The Federalists themselves said so. In Virginia, the governor, Edmund Randolph, was a Federalist, and he said that it would have only the enumerated powers. The Virginia Ratifying Convention said that, on numerous occasions, said that the federal government would have only the powers expressly delegated to it. The word expressly was used repeatedly in the ratifying conventions. It's the ratifying conventions, James Madison told us, to which we refer when we want to know what the Constitution means. So we know that the Constitution was supposed to be one of limited powers. Well, in fact, my opponent boasts about Hamilton's role in The Federalist. And indeed, in The Federalist, which is indeed a brilliant book, Hamilton does sell the Constitution to the public that way. I don't think it's quite enough to say, well, isn't that a super-duper book that he wrote? And not mention what he said after the book came out, and after the suckers had voted for the Constitution, what did he say then? Well, it turns out he was a big fat liar in The Federalist. And I think when we're talking about a man's personal merits, being a big fat liar with your pants on fire is a demerit against you. Because Hamilton said that the federal government is going to have only the enumerated powers, so don't worry about the general welfare clause. Of course, that's not an open-ended clause. Well, what did he say afterward? Now, by the way, the Federalist Papers, as they're called today, did not lead to the ratification of the Constitution. You already had 8 states that had ratified at the time it came out. We have no evidence that anybody changed his mind because of this document. New York was the only state that published all the articles of the Federalist. There were some states that didn't publish any of them. The importance of the document has been vastly overstated in terms of the actual impact it had on the ratifying process. Here's Richard Morris, the author of The Basic Ideas of Alexander Hamilton. He said, "Hamilton anticipated the later assumption by the Supreme Court of powers for the federal government on the basis of three clauses in the Constitution: the Necessary and Proper Clause, the General Welfare Clause, and the Commerce Clause. These three clauses, as Hamilton interpreted them, have provided the constitutional foundation for much of the activity of our modern federal government in the fields of taxation, finance, business regulation, and social welfare, activities undreamed of when the nation was in its infancy. To Hamilton, the enormous expansion of the power of the presidency by the 20th century would have been less a surprise than a vindication of his notions of the need for administrative power, energy, and efficiency." Now, my opponent says that Hamilton simply wanted an effective government, because a weak government leads to people getting slaughtered in the street and so on. And so he just meant effective. He didn't mean a government that would control everything. All right, well, how naive a political scientist would someone have to be to advocate the principles I am about to relate to you and think that they could describe a government that could possibly be kept limited? For example, on the Necessary and Proper Clause, we all know that Hamilton, as our social studies teachers told us approvingly, used that clause to argue for implied powers in the Constitution. Hey, we can't write everything down, come on. It's implied in there. And in fact, he concluded his discussion of this matter by saying, "Hence, consequently, the necessity and propriety of exercising the authorities entrusted to a government on principles of liberal construction." Principles of liberal construction, is that likely to yield you a free society in the long run? All you have to do is look around for your answer. You don't have to listen to me. You don't have to listen to Michael Malice. Just look around. You'll have your answer. His idea of implied powers was then codified in McCulloch versus Maryland, 1819, with John Marshall at times quoting Hamilton word for word. "So the bricks are being laid for the state under which we live today, using the very words of Hamilton himself." Hamilton's buddy Marshall, by the way, had nothing but contempt for the state ratifying conventions. This is where we're supposed to go to find out what the Constitution meant. You know, in all the 34 years John Marshall, Hamilton's buddy, was Chief Justice of the United States, you know how many times he cited the ratifying conventions in his decisions? Zero. Zero. Oh, but it gets better. It gets better. The General Welfare Clause. Now, in the Federalist, we were told the General Welfare Clause was only to apply to the way the enumerated powers are carried out, right? That obviously the general welfare, if we were to say that the Congress can spend money on anything it thinks will bring about the general welfare, well, that would authorize it to spend money on anything. And that was what we were told. However, afterward, Hamilton the liar tells us, "It was not fit that the constitutional authority of the Union to appropriate its revenue should have been restricted within narrower limits than the general welfare. And how about this? This necessarily embraces a vast variety of particulars which are susceptible neither of specification nor of definition." Does that sound like words that will lead to a free society? That's not what he said in The Federalist. He then went on to say, "It is therefore of necessity left to the discretion of the national legislature to pronounce upon the objects which concern the general welfare." So in other words, they'll tell us what's for the general welfare, and guess what? It'll be everything. And he says, "And there seems to be no room for a doubt that whatever concerns the general interests of learning, of agriculture, of manufactures, and of commerce are within the sphere of the national councils as far as regards an application of money." The exact opposite of what he told people to trick them into ratifying the Constitution. Exact opposite. So don't tell me, oh, well, he wrote the Federalist Papers, that makes him a hero. Yeah, then he denied them 5 seconds later. And by the way, if that argument sounds familiar, that the federal government, through the General Welfare Clause, is authorized to spend money on things not expressly delineated in the Constitution, if that sounds familiar, it's because that was John Roberts' deciding decision in the Obamacare case. That's why it sounds familiar. That is exactly what he argued. There's your hero. Let me quote you from Samuel Konevsky, who is the author of a revealing book, John Marshall and Alexander Hamilton, Architects of the American Constitution, utterly clueless title. He says, "No wonder the men who a century and a half later struggled to vindicate the New Deal's resort to federal spending found Hamilton's views so congenial and useful. All one need to do is examine his definition of general welfare, with its reference to learning, agriculture, manufacture, and commerce as permissible objects of federal expenditure." In the 1930s, Justice Cardozo, speaking about Social Security, said, "The conception of the spending power advocated by Hamilton and strongly reinforced by Joseph Story has prevailed over that of James Madison." Oh, but my favorite Hamilton quotation of all is coming up next. Here's what he thought about those little people we are supposed to despise. Here he is speaking about the national debt. "A national debt, if it be not excessive, will be to us a national blessing." It just sounds like Ayn Rand, right? Something she'd say, right? A national debt will be a national blessing. "It will be a powerful cement to our union." But here, the best part. "It will also create a necessity for keeping up taxation to a degree which, without being oppressive, will be a spur to industry." So in other words, if we have a national debt that the suckers have to pay taxes to pay the interest on, it'll keep those suckers working, you know, because otherwise they'll be lazy bums. And you think I'm putting those words into his mouth? Let's read the rest of it. "It were otherwise to be feared, our popular maxims would incline us to too great parsimony and indulgence. We labor less now than any civilized nation of Europe, and a habit of labor in the people is as essential to the health and vigor of their minds and bodies as it is conducive to the welfare of the state." So if we have a national debt, these little suckers will have to work their tails off to pay the interest, and that's good for them. We don't want them to be lazy. Wow, hero of liberty. That's the first phrase that comes to my mind. I could talk about Hamilton and the states, but I'll save that juicy stuff for later. I'll talk about Hamilton and the military, because of course the military came up. In 1798, the Alien and Sedition Acts were passed. Now, some of you are familiar, no doubt, with this notorious legislation. The most notorious aspect, of course, was the Sedition Act, which criminalized speech directed at the U.S. President or the U.S. Congress that would tend to bring it into ill repute. We had journalists who were imprisoned under that legislation. We even had a U.S. congressman from Vermont who had fought in the American Revolution, put in jail for this. Hamilton supported this vigorously, in fact, thought John Adams was not enforcing it vigorously enough. As a matter of fact, Hamilton even told the Speaker of the House, "If the president requires to be stimulated, those who can approach him ought to do it." So in other words, if we need to do a little something to get him moving, arresting more people, this is our hero of liberty, by the way. Let's make sure we get on that case. In 1799, Hamilton wanted an even more severe act against the freedom of speech passed. Then later, in arguing the need for a standing army in 1798, Hamilton said that he might wish to use it to, quote, "subdue a refractory and powerful state." What does he mean by that? Virginia. Because Virginia had this crazy idea that maybe there was something in the Constitution that said you can't put people in jail for criticizing John Adams.
Oh my goodness.
And from Hamilton's perspective, a legitimate use of the military involves using force against an American state, which, by the way, was an eventuality that in the Federalist he said was an absurdity and could never happen. But of course, we've seen how much we can rely on what he told us before the Constitution was ratified. So when I look at the whole thing taken together, what do I see? I see, and by the way, there were other founding fathers who, yes, they had heroic aspects of their character too, but who did not lie about the Constitution, who did not engage in these other behaviors. And what behaviors do I mean? Well, crony capitalism, advocacy of protective tariffs, a privileged national bank, the general welfare clause being interpreted in a plenary way, leaving to the discretion of Congress the power to decide what belongs to the general welfare, the necessary and proper clause being used to justify the idea of implied powers, saying one thing to achieve ratification and saying another after, reducing the states to mere administrative units of the central government, New Deal scholars saying they couldn't have done it without him, restrictions on free speech and favoring the army to subdue Virginia, I say if we have any principles whatsoever, we must absolutely reject the legacy of Alexander Hamilton and his claim to heroism. Thank you.
Remember how Marx at one point said, but I'm not a Marxist? It's amazing that, yes, it's true that Hamilton gets a lot of blame for what came after him. But let's look at some other people. Tom loves the 10th Amendment. He thinks the 10th Amendment is the best thing ever. You know who the biggest exponent of the 10th Amendment is nowadays? Mitt Romney. Because the 10th Amendment says, you know, the states are a laboratory of democracy and they let us choose and compete. What Tom doesn't understand is that people who are for the growth of government are not going to be playing fair. Thomas Jefferson was a big defender of rights, and Bernie Sanders will tell you with a straight face, we have a right to health care, therefore Thomas Jefferson is to be blamed for Bernie Sanders. That's nonsense. So let's talk about some of the other things that Tom brought up. First of all, Ludwig von Mises. Would you consider him a hero for the cause of liberty, Tom? Don't answer that. What did Mises say to Rand when she wrote Atlas Shrugged? You have the courage to tell the masses what no politician told them. You are inferior, and all the improvements in your conditions, which you simply take for granted, you owe to the effort of men who are better than you. Yes, Hamilton was for corruption in government in the sense that he was a realist. If you do not have wealthy people invested in the society, it's only going to lead to calamity. Everyone has to be invested to have this kind of engine of a society working. Otherwise, you have class warfare, as Tom would like. As Jefferson said, those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God. An interesting thing to say for someone who is notably an atheist. So what Hamilton did is he had the wealthy invested in the state and making America happen. Let's talk about something else. Let's suppose it's September 10th, 2001, and like myself and every other Jew, you knew what was going to happen the next day. We're not recording this, right? What would you do? Now, the people in this room would say, read the Galt speech, and Tom would say, hand out the Ron Paul newsletter to people. But what actually has to, when there's an emergency, you have to take emergency actions. And I don't bring up 9/11 lightly, because the British came in 1812 and burned down the White House. And you can imagine that imagery of what we saw on September 11th. If we saw the White House being burned down, this is a brand new country. He saw how hard it was to defend it. He was Washington's right-hand man, and he took the, yes, he had a standing army because his fears of an emergency were accurate. Yes, secondhand people, which Rand attacks constantly, pervert good ideas. They will invoke national security to justify all sorts of awful things. We have to have national security, therefore we have to go to Vietnam. That is nonsense. But that doesn't mean national security is not a real issue, and that Hamilton is the one who actually did something about it, as opposed to Jefferson, who said, we're just going to have militias fighting everyone all the time. Now, also notice how Tom called Hamilton a liar, and notice how he weaseled his way by saying, well, the Federalists didn't have anything to do with the Constitution passing, therefore let's blame the Federalists for everything in the Constitution that we don't like. Let's talk a little bit. There's this website called reddit.com, and there's something called Ask Me Anything, and one of the questions they always ask is, would you rather fight one horse-sized duck or 50 duck-sized horses, right? And there's two sides to that story. And this, if you don't have the federal government, you don't have freedom, what did Jefferson want? Jefferson thought that things like censoring people and putting them in prison were the prerogative of the state government. Now, am I freer because Albany's putting me in jail than Washington, D.C.? Albany and D.C. are not that far apart geographically from me. It's so when Tom is attacking what Hamilton's wanting, he's not providing an alternative. These were the choices on the table, and we still don't know. The only thing that creates a pro-liberty society are ideas. A constitution will never bind anyone. If you look at Roe v. Wade, and I'm pro-choice, but the idea that abortion is a right because of the right to privacy makes absolutely no sense linguistically, etymologically, or legally. People will pull anything wherever they want, and there is no way any constitution can be written that will bind them. That's just a matter of fact. Now let's talk something else. Tom, when I watched this great interview with Tom called The Weirdest Tom Interview Ever, and the guy asked you, who were your two political influences? And you said, Murray Rothbard and Hans Hermann Hoppe, right? And Hans Hermann Hoppe, one book, is called Democracy, the God That Failed, and he talks about how a limited king is often better than the mob. And that's what Hamilton believed and he fought for. Are you going to tell me Hans Hermann Hoppe is not a hero for the cause of liberty? Are you going to tell me he's wrong? These are valid perspectives, and that's the whole thing. In 1789, we didn't know what would work, and we still don't know. He just wanted to make sure that America had a chance to survive for a finite period, given the fact that the mob was, France was our closest ally. Are you going to tell me that the Americans were that much more civilized than the French, that the French Revolution couldn't happen here? Why? Are you going, the idea that the British were coming wasn't a fantasy. It actually happened. They burnt down the White House. So he's trying to create a nation that thinks of itself as a nation, so that what he saw happening with Washington would not have to happen again, that we would be prepared. Now, I know people like Tom think life insurance is a waste of money because you're throwing, you know, you're spending money every month and you get nothing for it, right? But there is an asymmetry. Yes, he was for taxation because the alternative isn't taxes or low taxes. The alternative is taxes or the British come back, we lose America, and that bright light of liberty that was the Constitutional Republic, something that had never been tried before and was a light for the whole world for centuries to come, was very, very delicate in those times. So it's very, very kind of absurd to say, well, but for Hamilton, none of these things would happen because he wasn't in Congress. Yes, he supported a lot of things that were wrong. That doesn't mean he wasn't a hero. Look, Ayn Rand said she was a male chauvinist, and she said she would never want a woman president because having a commander-in-chief of the army who's a female is unspeakable. Are you going to tell me Ayn Rand wasn't a hero for the cause of women? Are you going to tell me that, again, someone who fought in the Revolutionary War, someone whose writings are still studied as examples of what liberty means and whose lessons throughout the world have freed people? 1989, Poland became free because they had a constitution, and enough people, the ideas are what matter, not what's written, enough people said, it says here we have free elections, the government said, okay, we're going to listen, and Poland freed itself. That's the best way to free any country, is having the right ideas, and Hamilton's ideas, in many cases, were the right ones. And the fact that he put his life on the line, the fact that he wrote the Federalist, the fact that he was a self-made man, these are all heroic, inspirational examples. And yes, he did some things that were wrong. But again, when Ayn Rand went to visit Gerald Ford in the White House in the mid-70s and left, and she said, he's one of us, did she mean he meant the gold standard and he thought that Victor Hugo was the greatest writer ever? She goes, no, his ideas were inclined to be on the side of liberty. I'm just going to say one more sentence, literally one more sentence. When one of Rand's followers is going to go after Mises, Rand said, leave him alone, he's done enough. Just like Hamilton, a hero for the cause of liberty. Thank you.
Okay. I think we're having a drink after this. That's going to be a long conversation. Although I think we should discuss anything other than Hamilton for we talk. Okay, so you're going to, I didn't bring my watch, so you're...
Seven minutes.
And you'll show me at 5 and 3? Okay, all right. Well, okay, sometimes I feel like Michael's arguments just answer themselves in some ways, but I will answer some of them. First of all, I want to correct something. I did not say that I blame the Federalist for the situation. You said, how can you say the Federalist was not influential, but then you blame it for all the problems? I'm not blaming the Federalist. I'm blaming the fact that Hamilton lied about the Constitution and the Federalist and then did the opposite in the years after. That's what I blame. And so I think there's just way too much special pleading here to say, I mean, yes, look, there's no question that Hamilton on a personal level had some admirable qualities and he did some good thing. But that's true of an awful lot of people that we would not then say are heroes. Moreover, when we think about the consequences of Hamilton and what we live with today, how many of them can we uniquely say come directly from Hamilton? Can we uniquely say that Hamilton gave us our independence? No, but we can uniquely say that Hamilton gave us implied powers. He was the first one to articulate this idea. He gave us the crazy interpretation of the General Welfare Clause. I mean, all the demerits that I listed, these are all things that originate with Hamilton, have their origins in Hamilton. And yes, I realize that it's very fashionable to say that Hamilton's financial innovations were very important to the burgeoning America. That's what you got in your eighth grade textbook. Okay, we all read that. Where would we be if it hadn't been for tariffs or if it hadn't been for internal taxation on whiskey and Hamilton actually marching in or galloping in to oversee the suppression of the Whiskey Rebellion, a tax revolt, Hamilton being on the side of let's make these people pay the whiskey tax. which we got rid of and did pretty well without for the rest of the 19th century. So. But all these sorts of things. Where would we be without the first bank of the United States? Well, okay, between, if you look at an index, the best indexes that we can reconstruct in the 1790s of price inflation, in 5 years of the first bank, we have prices going up by about 72%. Oh, we couldn't have lived without that. Oh, but Hamilton gave us a single currency, so of course we're much better off. Well, you know, in the Constitution, there's a reference to the dollar. There's already a reference to the dollar in the Constitution, even before Hamilton came around, even before he created his bank. How could that be? Answer is, there was an existing silver standard in America. And that dollar in the Constitution is a very specific reference. It's a reference to something called the Spanish Mill dollar that was in wide circulation at the time. It was Hamilton's view and the view of every inflationist who has ever lived, including the very confused Benjamin Franklin, that there's a shortage of specie and that needs to be made up for by printing paper money. That was part of his justification. There's a shortage of specie and we need to print up paper money. Now, I can excuse or at least understand Benjamin Franklin taking that view, because guess whose print shop was going to get the contract to print up the paper money? So there's a little cronyism there. So I don't say that these financial innovations are so necessary. I might be partly willing to acknowledge Michael's point about the accepting the Revolutionary War debt and paying it at par. I mean, that still brings up moral questions, but I can see the Hamiltonian position there. But again, the fact that Hamilton wanted to build up the military, that makes it okay for him to be a liar about the Constitution? That makes that okay? I don't follow the argument. This is what we're living with today. The Obamacare decision, the ink is still wet on that thing, and it's Hamiltonianism through and through. And to say, oh, well, you know, it was young, you know, it was a young country. How could he know that saying we need principles of liberal construction? And how could he know that let's let the Congress decide what is for the general welfare? And how could he know that if we say manufacturing and commerce and industry and agriculture all falls under the national councils, how could he possibly have known that that would be abused? What kind of an imbecile are we dealing with here? When you look at words like that, and you say, well, you know, I mean, here we are in 2015, how can we judge him? I don't expect the guy to be infallible. But if he's going to be held up as a hero of the cause of liberty, he can't personally be the cause of so many of the struggles we are enduring right now. When you sit in that fourth grade social studies class, what interpretation of the Constitution are you getting? Alexander Hamilton all the way. I don't think we can overlook that. I don't think we can say he's a self-made man and that really inspires me. It does not inspire me that he laid the bricks. He put down the foundation and laid the bricks for the regime under which we live today. Every historian of Hamilton celebrates that fact. They don't hide from it. They celebrate it because they love what Hamilton has wrought. They love it. Well, I say we in this room, if we have principles, we must stand up against it, not love it, and despise it, and refuse to respect this line of thinking, and excuse it, and gloss over it like it's just a few unimportant things. This is the most important thing because it's had the most lasting effects on the lives of everyone in this room. So don't be swept away by the teary-eyed, beautiful statements of Michael Malice. This man was a monster. Thank you.
I'm going to begin by taking the moderator's prerogative to ask a question of either side. My question to begin with is to Michael Malice. Michael, is there something that Alexander Hamilton could have done, some thing or group of things that he could have done, which would have meant that his faults outweigh his virtues, that his faults were such that he could not be a hero for the cause of liberty? Is it at all possible that he could have done certain things that it would have outweighed his virtues?
Absolutely.
Is that at all possible?
I think that's a great question.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I would say there's a few things like, which are contemporary things like wars of choice, things like, you know, selling out you know, the slaveholder interests and furthering bad things like that. But again, these were tough times, and we did not know what a republic would look like in practice. And I just think it's a little absurd to blame Hamilton for Obama, you know, specifically. And of course, bad people like Hamilton, because as Tom said, everyone likes Hamilton. So as a subset of that, bad people will like him. I mean, that's just a Venn diagram.
All right, thanks for that answer. Tom Woods, my question to you. You have said that, again, the flip side is that you acknowledge some of the things that Hamilton did that are somewhat inspiring, that sound pretty good, but you've said the faults, the drawbacks, the harm he did way offsets the good, therefore he cannot be a hero for the cause of liberty. Probably a balanced assessment would apply to almost any founding father. I'm wondering this, can you pick any of Hamilton's contemporaries and say, despite his faults, he was indeed a hero for the cause of liberty? Is there anybody you can choose, and can you explain why?
Okay. Well, Michael and I think agree on this much, that if we were judging these men in the year 2015, we would find them all wanting. So I think
no. Would you want to hold them now?
Still, okay.
So would you rather have any of them than the presidents now? Come on.
Okay, yeah, that's true. But I would hope that today, as the ideas have developed,
they would get a little bit better than they were then.
Of course. All right. So given that, if I give an answer, people will say, "But Woods, what about this?" Yeah, I know. I know. You can say, "What about this?" to all of them. But I would say, if I had to be pinned down. It's hard because there are serious drawbacks to all of them. Mm-hmm. There are heroic actions, people who made physical sacrifices. I get all that. But then at the same time, there are plenty of people who made sacrifices who then were involved in moral enormities. And it's very hard to say, well, that's entirely heroic. But I do have some respect for James Madison, who collaborated with Hamilton, of course, in the Federalist.
Right.
And who professional Madison historians will try to claim that he was absolutely consistent throughout his life. No. That's the Lance Banning thesis.
No.
He obviously was not completely consistent throughout his life, but he did have heroic periods where he recognized the threat, for example, of the Hamiltonian system. He could see where the Hamiltonian interpretation of the Constitution was going to lead. And in fact, by the way, here's a real difference between Madison and Hamilton. Hamilton knew that the Constitution that had been ratified was not what he wanted. And he had made that perfectly clear. Everybody knew what his position was. Madison also was complaining about it. He privately, in a letter to Thomas Jefferson, said that he didn't expect it to last more than a few years. He thought there were a lot of problems with it. But the difference is, Madison understood that's the Constitution we have. And this is the Constitution that was sold to the people on the basis of enumerated powers and the powers of the states. That's not the system Madison wanted, as we know from his nationalist plan. He did not want to be called the father of the Constitution, but his view was, this is the Constitution we gave the people, so this is the one I will defend. I can't do a bait and switch on them, like Hamilton did. Sell them one thing and then do another. No, we sold them this, warts and all, and so I have to be loyal to this document. So that's why I can respect Madison.
Hamilton, through supporting the Constitution, helped or give us liberty as far as the state of the country of the United States. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So the question is then, if the Articles of Confederation were not good enough, then I assume would be your position, that we would never have gotten liberty? And if that's the case, can I bring up Afghanistan? Can I bring up Algeria? Can I bring up Vietnam? Can I bring up any other country that is smaller, and the United States was much bigger geographically than Great Britain, how would we not have gotten liberty at that time if the people who were inhabiting the country at that time wanted liberty? Could they have not have gotten it very easily?
All right, that's true.
If you think liberty has ever gotten very easily, I don't know what to tell you, number one. And number two is, yeah, we could have all sorts of imaginary scenarios that, you know, the South won the Civil War and slavery continued, so on and so forth. Unlike Tom, I'm dealing in reality.
Oh.
And the fact of the matter is, the world is a much better, I don't know that it would have what the alternative would have been, I think it is undeniably true that the world is a much better place and more pro-liberty because America as America existed, and we all agree with this because we're here.
He's writing, is that a quill pen?
Okay.
Yes, Tom, I came prepared.
This is a question mainly for Tom Woods. Okay. Is National Review's Richard Brookhiser, who wrote about a book about Hamilton, wrong when he says that though Hamilton made some statist mistakes, he was so radically libertarian by today's standards that, for instance, he thought even if the federal government wanted to do something as simple as build a canal, it would have to pass an amendment to the Constitution?
Well, if that's the case, I mean, but yet he doesn't think there needs to be an amendment to the Constitution for a national bank or for bounties to industry and so on. So that seems to me much too selectively applied for him to be considered I mean, that was certainly Jefferson's view. And even though Jefferson, and we're not here to debate Jefferson.
Speak for yourself.
No, I'm here to debate the resolution.
That's nice.
I want to debate the resolution. I want to stay on point, because I feel like that's our role here. Jefferson favored some kind of public education, and he even favored federal involvement in education, and every leftist in the world cites that, but they don't cite the rest of the sentence where he says, of course we'd have to amend the Constitution first. Well, they forget that part because nobody wants to do that. I think Jefferson consistently applied that principle, but if this is true about Hamilton and canals, I think his views on the expansive, I mean, his view basically is that given that the Congress, he says it, the Congress has the power to tell us what's in the general welfare, then it leads us to then have to rely on whatever idiosyncratic view of Hamilton might happen to be on a given day, that this isn't part of the general welfare, and therefore, you know, we would have to amend the Constitution. But he's not in Congress, so it wouldn't be, even according to his own principles, wouldn't be his place to say. If Congress believed that canals could be dug, then according to his own principles, they can be dug. So I don't think it works. I think it's special pleading.
Mike, you have a comment?
Well, yeah, I think, again, it's kind of like Nancy Pelosi, Tom's hero, when she said about Obama.
No, she's your hero.
Oh, zinger. Have you been working on that one all night? Are you Australian with that boomerang? When Nancy Pelosi said that we have to pass Obamacare to know what's in it, that is how legislation works. We can talk all day long about Atlas Shrugged and the Constitution, but until these laws are passed and put into practice by men who have free will, paper is not going to bind people. It's the right ideas that bind people, and many of these ideas that have lasted to this day, especially an America of industrialism and production as opposed to an agrarian wasteland.
No.
If you want to say what is exclusively Hamilton's, it's the vision of a city of skyscrapers of New York that so enticed Ayn Rand and so enticed us, as opposed to this feudalism that your boy Jefferson and Madison.
Okay, all right, now
so
hold
much.
On a minute here. Now just wait.
I'm done.
No.
And so are you.
Now listen to me.
I'm listening, baby.
Yeah. Look, okay, first of all, that is, I hope that the objectivists in the room can hear pathetic pandering when they hear it, right? Because we're all thinking, skyscrapers, we love them.
Sound that
this guy favors skyscrapers.
Tom, your pandering's not that pathetic.
Now listen. It's true that Jefferson was an agrarian. But what made Jefferson different from Hamilton in this regard is that he did not favor special government bounties to support his preferred lifestyle. His view was we let society evolve as it will. And he did believe that in the long run it would evolve away from his preferred system. But he wasn't going to have federal bounties for one particular system or another. In other words, he believed in this regard, he believed in the principles of a free society. He did not believe in crony capitalism in the name of industrialization, which is exactly the Hamiltonian.
He believed in the full estate tax. That's not the principles of free society.
Okay, we want a question in the back.
Wasn't the most honest and the most definitive argument against Hamilton delivered by Aaron Burr?
Oh.
That's the question.
I'll answer that there. If you're applauding murder, you don't know what liberty is. I don't know what to tell you, buddy. You're in the wrong room. So Aaron Burr came to Alexander Hamilton at one point when Hamilton was in charge of the army, and he said, General Hamilton, you have the power to kind of seize control and take over. And Hamilton says, I don't think that's constitutionally right, and there's this little thing called morality that I have a problem with there as well. And what did Aaron Burr say? All things are moral to great souls. And he said it in French. So in 1804, Hamilton, who is clearly a hero for the cause of liberty, endorsed his arch enemy and paid for it with his life because he knew an honest opponent is better for a country than a venal man who you agree with. Is that not integrity? Is that not heroism? Go ahead, Tom. Defend Aaron Burr. Defend murder like you like to do. And slavery.
Okay, you shut up. Will you shut up?
No. If you're telling me I have to shut up, you know you've lost.
Okay, that was out of order, Tom. We have another.
Thank you, Gene. A real hero for the cause of liberty, Gene Epstein.
I accept that.
Okay, we have another question.
Okay, so when we're talking about liberty, I'm assuming we're talking about property rights. We're not talking about
correct. The
liberty to rob people, Bernie Sanders, any of that.
Correct.
Crazy leftist nonsense. So when we're saying that Alexander was a beneficial influence on the cause of liberty, are we talking about that relative to the English Empire or relative to the rest of the founding fathers? So my question is basically, if Alexander didn't even exist, would we be a more libertarian society today without him?
I don't think even Tom would claim that if Hamilton never existed, this would be Galt's Gulch.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, that's not these things are very complicated. But Tom brought up something which I think really is an example of Hamilton being a hero for the cause of liberty, which is Hamilton was a lawyer in New York, and he was defending the loyalists, the Tories. These are the people who sided with the British Empire during the war. They were on the wrong side of history, so to speak. And there were all these laws being passed in New York to strip them of their property. And Hamilton fought for them, even though he fought against them physically in the war, he fought for them to maintain their property rights against the majority opinion and the legislature at the time. And in my view, any lawyer who puts his reputation on the line to defend extremely unpopular people who you just defeated in a war because property rights trump all, that is a hero for the cause of liberty. If that were a book, everyone in this room would be reading it and recommending it to their friends.
Comment? Yeah. No.
Well, given that I conceded that point, I don't have to elaborate on it, but I'll say that if we were living in a situation where we were constantly confronted with that situation and we had Hamilton's good example to inform us, then that would be a wonderful thing.
We are constantly confronted with that.
But there are no Tories we have to defend any longer.
What about the gay wedding cakes? Like, people are being forced to do things because they have the wrong idea all the time. Their property rights are not respected.
That's because, according to the Commerce Clause, we can have civil rights legislation.
No, it's because the statism.
And we only got that crazy interpretation of the Commerce Clause because of Hamiltonians. We wouldn't be in this situation if it weren't for Hamilton.
Yeah, yeah. Another question.
I wonder if you can respond to the argument that was raised that a lot of Alexander Hamilton's early...
I guess you could say problematic moves... Were problematic positions had to do with his reasonable view that the U.S. was in a precarious situation and there was a chance of being attacked, and that doesn't in hindsight is 2020. It's sort of hard to it would not justify anything today going forward. We now have a lot more evidence that this kind of governmental structure could work than was really evident back then. And so I wonder, just because that argument was raised, I wonder if you can address that.
I think there's a fairly simple answer to it, which is that if you believe what you just said, if Hamilton believed that, the country's in a precarious position, so we don't have time for all these constitutional niceties. We've just got to do what we have to do to firm up the finances and get the military going. Then you get a constitutional amendment. And that's what the system says. The Constitution, which I know, look, the Constitution does not have an expiration date on it, and it doesn't say, look, if times get tough, then forget this whole thing and chuck it out the window, or pretend that it says the opposite of what it says. It says that there's a way to amend the Constitution. If you don't use the amendment process, and you simply engage in special pleading all the time. Well, now's an exception, because now's an emergency. Yeah, the U.S. government's been in a state of emergency officially since 1950. And then they're never going to get out of that state of emergency. If you say that, under certain circumstances of today, we have to bypass the Constitution, they'll always be bypassed. There'll always be some reason to ignore it. So you instead go to the amendment process and you change it in the open and upfront way you think it needs to be changed. Unless you think that a better society is one in which we leave it up to, which is the only alternative, We leave it up to the goodwill of human beings to decide when the rules of the Constitution need to be suspended. There is no alternative.
Those are the two alternatives? Are you out of your mind? Okay, look, when Obamacare was being passed, Nancy Pelosi, Tom's hero, she was asked if it's constitutional. And her answer was, are you serious? Are you serious? And I'm being sincere here. Tom, I think you're being a little naive in this sense. When people who are statists, who are strongly for government, they are going to find any excuse to latch onto to further their interest, because it doesn't really matter what it says on paper. They're just going to use an ex post facto rationalization. So, and one more thing. If there is an actual emergency like September 11th, I don't know that it's not a violation of property rights that the FAA shut down all the flights, but I'm glad they did. And again, his fears that the British were coming were, in fact, prophetic and borne out.
So I have a question just regarding Hamilton's time later in life. It hasn't really been brought up, or later in his life that was cut short. But the time during which he was not in elected office at all, during the Adams administration, he jockeyed through the Federalist-controlled Congress for the establishment of a provisional army. He then declined many positions that were offered to him in both state government and federal government because he himself wanted to be commander-in-chief of this provisional army. When he became inspector general, because George Washington was named commander-in-chief of this provisional army, he had his six-year-old son write a letter that he dictated to a man, Francisco de Miranda, in Venezuela, who was looking to liberate Venezuela so that he himself could become commander-in-chief of that force in Venezuela. And then when Adams found out about all this in the, you know, right before the election of 1800, he basically tore into Hamilton, and Hamilton effectively challenged him to a duel that he declined. He didn't even answer the letter. So the bigger point I'm making here is I think that Alexander Hamilton's, once he became more influential, he became more corrupt. And I don't, you know, personally, I don't know that that can be a hero of liberty or for liberty.
Why is he corrupt? Because he wrote a letter?
No, he's corrupt because he was jockeying to create a provisional army that he himself was, he was declining positions to jockey to control that army.
Do you think, so he just wanted to control the army for the sake of power, even though Burr said, if you're in control of this army, you could seize power, and he said, no, I won't do it because of morality. So anyone who's in charge of an army is ipso facto not a hero for the cause of liberty and immoral?
No.
I'm talking nonsense.
No, it's not really nonsense. I'm saying that he was trying to establish this army so that he himself could, well, I'm not a debater, but...
You're also speculating, which is something that Hamilton liked. Hamilton was the only founding father who liked speculators, and this is a society dedicated to speculation.
All right.
I think Tom's not going to say that Alexander Hamilton was some kind of Pinochet figure, who wanted to have some kind of military junta.
Thomas, no.
But I
would say that we don't have to speculate, that we do know, because he said so, that he was perfectly prepared to use the military against a state that was defying the Sedition Act.
Correct.
This is just a small matter, a trivial footnote in the life of Alexander Hamilton. I mean, that, to me, that's an extremely revealing moment in his life.
It's a reveal, yes. Look, you say 50 horse-sized ducks. Hamilton says one duck-sized horse. The idea that, like, states equals freedom, federalism equals tyranny.
Let me finish.
We've tried both, and neither of them are... Look at Central America. That's all a bunch of little states. Is Central America some laissez-faire paradise? Look at the EU. You have this weak federal system, and you have little states. Is the EU some laissez-faire capitalist paradise? The fact of the matter is, the only thing any of us know in this room that moves liberty forward are the correct ideas, and many of these ideas are in the popular consciousness because of Alexander Hamilton and the Federalist Party, including the idea that democracy is very, very dangerous.
Tom, your case is devastating. I came in on the pro side. I'm not totally con, but...
Devastating sounds pretty bad.
But it's one thing to say that he changed his mind about things after the fact. You went further than that. You said he deliberately deceived in selling. What evidence do you have for
because,
that?
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, okay, good. I guess my evidence is every Federalist, every major Federalist certainly in Virginia, but fair enough that he's not familiar with Virginia. But the Federalist case in the Federalist Papers was, don't worry, this government will have only the enumerated powers. Now, unless we are dealing with the greatest coincidence in the history of the world, that it so happens that the very moment that he has influence over the U.S. government, all of a sudden, he now implements the principles that he all along wanted to implement. I believe it is a case of we're dealing with he wanted a constitution that went one way. He didn't get it, but he pretends that he did.
Okay.
But yeah, also, like John Marshall, for example, he was sitting there when in Virginia they all said this is going to be a limited government. He was sitting there throughout it, and then when he writes all his Hamiltonian Supreme Court decisions, he says the exact opposite of everything that we know he heard them say.
You are doing guilt by association, Hamiltonian, and let's talk about honesty in government. At one point, when Hamilton was Treasury Secretary, Jefferson got the idea, well, I can't defeat this man politically, so I'm going to defeat him personally. And the following story, every libertarian should know, every free marketer should know, because it is this anecdote in and of itself is someone who's a hero for the cause of liberty. What happens? They say, you know, there's financial irregularities in your department you're stealing. He goes, no, I'm not. They go, prove it. You've got 3 months. Prove you didn't steal. This is the textbook attack of people who use the state to destroy people personally, which we see to this day in the IRS. What did Hamilton do? In 6 weeks, he audited the department on his own, accounted for every penny, which showed he was absolutely irreproachable, and basically gave him the finger and said, here you go, I didn't steal anything. Any man who is falsely accused for political views by the federal government and then proves himself innocent and takes them down is a hero. Now, I know the objection is, well, he created this federal government, you reap what you sow. Of course, because if this would never happen in Albany, right? This would be, and the facts of the story would be completely different above a certain latitude because honesty happens there. That is the story of a hero for the cause of liberty, anyone who takes on the entire federal government and wins due to his integrity. No answer, exactly. Once again, the resolution passes.
I don't see that is... I'm talking about the legacy of the man.
I'm talking about the man. The resolution is about the man, not his legacy.
The man, no.
The resolution is about
the cause of liberty.
It's not Alexander's, Hamilton's legacy was the best thing ever.
No, it was, the resolution is not Alexander Hamilton was a super guy.
That's what hero means.
For the cause of liberty,
yes.
Specifically.
Yes.
I don't mean that he rescued cats from trees.
He was also, he could be cause for other things too. For immigrants, he was a hero for the cause of immigrants. They're not contradictory. I'm not saying that you think they are.
Yeah, but I think when you're bringing in, when you're trying to say that he had many admirable personal qualities, I think you're shifting the ground of the debate. I don't think...
Heroism? That wasn't an example of heroism, that story I just told?
Rosa Parks
sat in a bus. I sit in a bus every day. She's a hero because she took a stand that one day. That one day defines her. Well, he had many such actions throughout his life.
But how can his constitutional interpretations, when that's what we live with today, how can that not define him? How is that just...
You are granting the left the quality of intellectual honesty which they don't have.
I'm not saying that they wouldn't have come up with something.
Exactly. Thank you.
But
I rest my case.
No.
Let's vote.
No.
That's exactly my point.
No.
Yes. That's exactly my point.
So in other words, so it's okay that he hands them the arguments on a silver platter, and that's fine with you. And he establishes
the idea. What do you have against silver? I thought you liked silver.
He establishes the idea that there are, you know, a couple of different ways to look at the Constitution, so that today we're all stuck saying, well, you know, my view is such and such. I'm a strict constructionist. And other people say, well, I belong more to the Hamilton school. There shouldn't have been that school. It should have been 100 times harder.
That school has existed in every country since the beginning of time.
But he said America was so different thanks to Alexander Hamilton.
Right, because he is the one who understood property rights are absolute. He's the only founding father who believed this, regardless if you're wealthy, if you're a loyalist, if you're a speculator, or anything, or if you're an immigrant.
Okay.
He is the founding father who, more than anyone else, had the libertarian view that property rights trump everything else, including the vote.
So property rights is not infringed by the idea that we'll have a large national debt because paying the interest will keep the suckers working hard enough so they can afford the taxes. That's a respect for property rights.
If he used the word suckers, I concede this debate entirely.
I think that is highly immaterial.
Well, okay. We have
Are you going to tell me that a Revolutionary War hero who is a brilliant general like Benedict Arnold wasn't a hero for us that we should celebrate?
Wait. Everyone.
You keep saying things like.
I heard you. I'll answer you.
Do you
every
think,
sing. Do you want me to answer?
Was Benedict Arnold the hero for the cause of liberty?
Is the question. In America today.
Yeah, was Benedict Arnold?
Benedict Arnold wasn't a founding father. Every one of the founding fathers, what did Benjamin Franklin say? We must all hang together or we will most assuredly hang separately. They laid their lives on the line for a free America. They all had the same goal, a free America, and they had different visions of how to technically execute it. And none of them have the A1 100% correct answer. That's true. But they are all, excuse me? They are all indisputably heroes for the cause of liberty. There's plenty of heroism to go around in that era.
So if you're asking me, unless someone was evil from being an infant, they're a hero because they did something good at some point in their time.
If someone did something heroic at some point in their life, yes, they're a hero. That's English.
So was Hitler a hero?
Benedict Arnold is not a hero, no.
Okay, Benedict Arnold is not. Do you have an answer? Do you have one of them coming?
He's a Canadian. He can't be a hero.
I guess what is especially peculiar about the Hamiltonian position here and his military career is that afterward, he then advocates the very principles of the system he fought in the war against. He advocates the establishment of the British system within American borders, whether it was the British political system, or it was the British economic system, or basically a British style approach to eventually to foreign affairs. This is what he establishes. So what? There's something weird and discordant about that, it seems to me.
It's weird that I'd rather be ruled from D.C. than London, even though I like the London system. That doesn't make any sense.
So the whole thing was just about they're too far away.
Okay. Yeah, that's what no taxation without representation means, Tom. Okay. It's a phrase you might be familiar with.
A little bit more of a lighthearted question, just how brilliant you think Hamilton was. Do you think Hamilton thought that the best way to get skyscrapers would be to install the first bank? Since according to Mark Thornton, his skyscrapers hypothesis arrive on the eve of the crash, which we owe to the first bank.
What?
Sorry. So Mark Thornton theorizes that...
Who's Mark Thornton?
He's a senior fellow of the Mises Institute. He has
So he thinks that skyscrapers arrive on the eve of a crash, which we'd owe to a central bank.
Well, the largest skyscraper...
Skyscrapers were built, he's asking me, were built during the Great Depression. The Empire State Building was built in 18 months during the Great Depression, so I don't see how that thesis holds.
No, but since that... No? Since Hamilton wanted a central bank, do you think that's why he wanted a central bank, so we'd have skyscrapers? Because you said that Hamilton...
Hamilton wanted a central bank in order to have skyscrapers? No. I've answered your question.
Yeah. All right, one final question.
Tom, you don't want to respond to that? Are you going to say Hamilton didn't want skyscrapers because of the
central bank?
What's your question?
So, Tom, your podcast a few weeks ago focused on the French Revolution, and especially the terror. There's the economist line, how's your wife?
Compared to what?
Right. Yeah. Compared to what? I mean, in that time, in the 1790s, when Hamilton's really in the mill, you have what's happening in France, which is terrifying. Would you have I'm not saying you would have preferred that, but Hamilton certainly did protect against that kind of thing happening here, which even though I agree with almost everything you're saying, compared to the French Revolution, I'd much rather have what happened here.
That's true, but I consider that such a false dichotomy. I think it's classic Hamiltonian hysteria.
Hysteria?
To paint the small government libertarian Republicans as being would-be Jacobins. I do not think John Taylor of Caroline. I'm talking.
No, I'm looking up your quote.
In the 1790s, I concede the point about Jefferson. I'm not here to debate Jefferson. There were plenty of people, like, for example, as I say, John Taylor of Caroline is one of the most effective liberty pamphleteers of the 1790s. That's why you've never heard of him, by the way. We've all read the report on manufacturers by Hamilton.
I haven't.
I prepared for the debates.
Sure doesn't seem like it.
Wow.
Oh, you've been working on that one all night, Michael?
Yeah, I got it with my quill pen.
The point is, if I read John Taylor, if I read John Randolph of Roanoke, if I read these people who defined the Republican cause, James Madison himself, I see nothing that bears anything whatsoever in common with the murderous mobs of the French Revolutionary Terror. So I think, but this was the sort of partisan rhetoric that was used against the early Republican Party to demonize them in the minds of the public. But thankfully, by 1800, it didn't work anymore.
Can I say something on that?
Please do.
This
Please
is the,
do.
This
Please
is the,
keep digging on this one. Go ahead.
This is the Piers Morgan argument. Piers Morgan last year had Ben Shapiro on his show, and Piers Morgan's very much for gun control, and Ben Shapiro goes, look, as a Jew and my grandparents, I want us all to have guns just in case, because it's asymmetric. You know what I mean? It's not like flipping a coin, like I'm going to have sushi or I'm going to have steak. It's like, am I going to be free or are we all going to be murdered? So when Tom is saying the Piers Morgan position, oh, it'll be fine. Don't worry about it. It can't happen here, right? Why? These were our closest allies, and the Whiskey Rebellion was the start of this. Maybe it would not have been decapitation in the streets, but it sure could have gotten very ugly very fast, and it can get very ugly very fast to this day.
The Whiskey Rebellion was a failure to pay an excise tax. Throughout most of the backcountry, the whiskey tax was not being paid at all. There were no mobs rising up. It was simple civil disobedience.
What do you call the revolution?
It was civil disobedience. What created the violence was Alexander Hamilton galloping in to put down these people who weren't complying with his whiskey tax. Now, I support people who are fighting against taxes because I think taxes are an imposition on liberty.
I agree. Yeah. But I don't think state taxes versus federal taxes means it's a libertopia, number one. And number two is there were mob attacks during the Civil War draft riots, which were, I'm against the Civil War, of course. There were mob attacks last year. So this idea that it would never happen here, it can't happen here, flies in the face of logic and actual facts.
Oh, but a mob is not the same thing as the Jacobins getting control of a regime.
It literally
there
is.
There is no tradition of that
is.
Thought in,
Especially
in,
if
Anglo-American,
it's a small state.
In Anglo-American political writing. There is no basis for that whatsoever. This is entirely a fantasy.
It's a fantasy, and yet they're decapitated on the streets.
We'll have to make this the final question. So,
Mr. Woods, would you concede that pre-1787, Hamilton was at least instrumental to the cause of liberty, despite what I believe you're stating about Hamiltonian principles being anti-liberty at present?
I think on balance, yes. Now, that does not mean that he's a hero for the cause of liberty, because I believe he then undoes everything he claimed to be doing. That's nice that he gives me with one hand, but the hand that he's taking from is like one of these giant balloon hands, you know, like we're number one, and he grabs it all back and more, and we're still living with it today. All the same legal arguments, all there, all courtesy of Alexander Hamilton.
Those aren't balloons, those are foam.
Okay, Michael.
And frankly, if you have a hand that says we're number one, yes, America is number one thanks to Hamilton, and that's not a bad place to be.
Michael, you want to take the podium and do a five-minute summary?
I am going to pander because this is something that I completely agree with. Towards the end of her life, Ayn Rand was on Tom Snyder's show, and Tom Snyder said to her, "You love this country, don't you?" And she said, "Yes, passionately, very, very much, and consciously. I love this country for its ideas." And there's plenty of heroes to choose from in this era, by the way. "And I've seen enough of the other side," she said, "so I can appreciate this country." And Tom says, "You might even get emotional about this country." She goes, "Oh, yes, you want me to get emotional?" And he goes, "You might even thank God for it." And she goes, "I might not literally mean a God, but I like what that expression means. Thank God or God bless you. It means the highest possible to me, and I would certainly thank God for this country." So you're about to vote, and when you make this decision, it might be well if you ask yourself, is the world better off than it was 200 years ago? Are there more places in the world where people are free to practice their faith and have a free economy, open up what jobs they have and social mobility? If your answer to these questions are yes, well then I think it's obvious who you will vote for. If you don't agree, if you don't think that the course that the world has been on for the last 200 years on the American side is the course that you would like to see us follow in the future, then I suggest another choice you might have. Vote for Tom and go to North Korea. Thank you.
Well, that is a pretty stark choice, isn't it? Wow. North Korea or America? Which way do you vote? Well, I suggest that there is a bit more nuance to the question, as a matter of fact. So I'd like to lay that out a bit here before we wrap up for tonight. Well, I very much appreciate, again, I mean, this is a tremendous audience. I'm very glad to be here with Michael Malice. This whole thing actually began as an episode
of my show. We talked about Hamilton because I love arguing with Michael, and we agree on so many things that when we find a place where we disagree, we almost get giddy. Here's a chance to fight it over because it's fun. We enjoy doing it. And on that episode, I'll speak for myself, but I had a blast on that episode. I don't remember what number it is, but by the way, I'm into the 500s, Mr. 370 whatever. I'm in the 500s of episodes. So anyway, if you're not listening at tomwoods.com, shame, shame, everybody knows your name. However, we have said much more tonight than we said then. We've had a greater opportunity to flesh out our positions. So I'm going to reply briefly to a couple of things that Michael said, and then I'm going to sum up my position. First, Michael is not at all convinced that decentralization may have any connection with liberty, because Albany is just as oppressive as Washington, D.C. Well, I don't know that Boise is necessarily as oppressive as Washington, D.C., or, you know, any capital you can think of necessarily. I mean, sure, there are terrible places in this country, like Maryland. Wouldn't want to live there. Massachusetts, pretty rough. A lot of pretty rough places to live. That's true. But decentralization is actually how liberty first developed in Western civilization, according to a very substantial school of historical thought, which tells us that it was precisely the fact that the European landscape was marked by a series of very small principalities, margraves, bishoprics, republics that yielded you liberty because the ability of the population to exit was relatively easy. That is one of the only constraints. It's true, no piece of paper is going to restrain sociopaths. But if I can walk away, that can constrain them. They don't want me to walk away because then they can't fleece me anymore. So that is the connection. That's why F.A. Hayek said that in the future, liberty is much more likely to flourish in small states. And there are plenty of small states in the world that are wonderful places to live. So decentralization plays an essential role in the development of liberty in Western civilization. The Dutch Federation was also a case of decentralization, and the American Founding Fathers were very fond of the Dutch Federation. Secondly, I didn't really say that much about Hamilton and the states, other than he wanted the federal government to, quote, triumph altogether over the state governments and reduce them to utter subordination. Now, that is the principle that has been held by every dictator who ever lived. I don't know of any dictator who said, let's decentralize because that'll be better for my dictatorship. Can't think of any. So there is a connection between decentralization and liberty, and this means that Hamilton, once again, is on the wrong side. Our history has always been a history of decentralization. The United States in the U.S. Constitution is consistently referred to, not in the singular, but in the plural. In the plural for a reason. Because unlike all the other countries in the world, the United States were unique because they were a collection of societies. That's all gone now. We don't have that anymore. And we can thank, if not Alexander Hamilton personally, then the political tradition of which he was the architect. Let's recap what we have with Hamilton. This is unavoidable. Crony capitalism, protective tariffs, a privileged inflationary national bank, three constitutional clauses interpreted to mean the Federal Congress can do pretty much anything. Reasoning that is used as recently as the Obamacare decision. We have saying one thing before ratification and conveniently the other afterward. We have states being reduced to mere administrative units of the central government. We have the support of restrictions on free speech and even advocacy of the use of the U.S. Army against a recalcitrant state. Whatever merits Alexander Hamilton may have, I am afraid that this list must lead us to conclude that he forfeits them as a hero for the cause of liberty. Thank you. All right, I hope you enjoyed that. Michael and I sure did. The results are as follows. Before the debate, the audience poll revealed 16% of people in favor of the resolution, that is, in favor of Michael's position, 41% against, that is, they supported my view, and 43% undecided. After the debate, Michael's total was 26%. My total was 66%, with 8% undecided. So I was the winner. There you go. After all the abuse I was taking on Twitter from Malice, I let him have it in the debate. But we had such fun. We're trying to think of something else we might be able to debate. We're going to talk about that in tomorrow's episode. You're going to enjoy tomorrow's episode as we go back and look at this and talk about it and think about the future. How can we put on a spectacle like this again? Well, I really do hope you enjoyed it. Check out tomwoods.com/551, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.